Welcome to Street Hypnosis. This is session 3 of the masterclass entitled Discover the Hypnotic Profiling Secrets that let you read people like an open book, anytime, anywhere, with anyone. What I'd like to focus in this session is the question of psychometric tests. Now, psychometric tests has a long history, almost as long as the field of psychology itself. It's the idea that you can measure people's personality or personality traits according to some kind of measurements or yardstick. We're going to have a look at the whole field of psychometric evaluation in a moment to find out its pros, its cons, its flaws, and its advantages. But before we do, I want you to recognize that all the things you've learned in sessions 1 and session 2 have built a foundation which for some people takes years of psychological experimentation and learning fancy theories, etc., to get hold of. The irony is, the things that we've covered are things that psychologists have come to or conclusion have drawn over and over and over again on their own, and just coming from different theories, different backgrounds, different things, the same kind of patterns keep emerging. So rather than trying to reinvent the wheel and then trademarking it so you can have your own particular license and pay hundreds of dollars to, or have a corporation pay you hundreds of dollars so you can do the tests for them, I thought I'd give you the tools first and then show you how you might be able to transform them to a more formal educational system. In other words, the kind of thing you'll find schools and corporations and academic institutions using and validating. Essentially, in order to use one of these tools in a big organization sort of way, one way to use them is not tell them you're using it and just use the profiling system that we've talked about. The other way to use them is to use the methods we're going to talk about here and just create your own test, give it your own name, trademark it, and before you know it, you're in exactly the same poach, giving them exactly the same information as all these other tests are doing. And just because you've got your own label on it means you get to charge $100 a go rather than having to pay someone else for the pleasure of doing so. Now, the field of psychological testing or psychometric testing is pretty old. The very first set of psychometrics, all the way to the turn of the last century, were really there to try and measure IQ, people's intelligence. Now, I think it's been established since then that intelligence can't be measured, or at least not in the terms according to that test. The classic test, of course, is something called the Stanford-Binet IQ test. Binet being the research scientist at Stanford University that created the test. Now, there are a bunch of problems with psychometric testing, which the classic IQ test is a great example of as well. And I'd like you to just run you through these a little bit first, so you understand the limitations first, the criticisms which the field in general has not managed to overcome yet, so that you understand that when someone tells you a profile or tells you you're this IQ or you're this kind of person, etc., well, there's actually a lot more leeway in it. Things are actually a lot less sure than people are trying to make out them to be. And this is partly to do with commercial reality. You know, it's very difficult to sell something unless you can guarantee its results. It's also partly to do with the experimenter being in love with his own ideas to the point where they create a rigid rule set. This has to be this way. This is always this way. And look, I have all this data to prove it. The very first problem we come across when looking at psychometric testing in any terms other than the sort of laissez-faire, rough guide approach that we've been talking about in sessions 1 and 2. In other words, one which you use more as a guideline than as a definitive measure of what someone is like. The very first problem with this is the question of what are you measuring? How are you going to measure something? Now, if you're going to measure distance, for example, it's easy to measure things because you can compare one distance to another. You just create an instrument like a ruler with the same kind of yardstick, the same kind of distances between it. So as soon as you measure one thing with the same ruler and you measure another thing with the same ruler, well, you'll know that you can equate the two. One road and the other road are the same length because the same ruler measured them. Then you can create other rulers based on the same original ruler, and as long as no error creeps in, you have a pretty safe, pretty standard way of measuring things against each other. The problem comes when you enter the subjective realm, when you're talking about emotions, when you're talking about ideas, when you're talking about ways of being. What are you measuring? How much are you measuring? So this is something that the ancient Greeks knew about a long, long time ago, and they made a great big point. They really went to great lengths to avoid the mistake of saying, well, on a scale of 1 to 10, how happy are you? They just can't do that. Now, we're used to doing that. We think that's quite normal because we've been educated to think in those ways. We've been educated to think in those ways by magazine articles, little Cosmo tests, you know, scale of happiness from 1 to 10. And that's a result of these psychometric tests. Someone took the psychometric test, simplified it even more, and then the dummies version was put inside an article that everyone looked at and go, oh, wow, this is so much fun. And fine, as long as it's a bit of fun, it's no problem. The problem arises when people start thinking that what they've measured is real. In other words, you can compare two things. Your score of happiness is 7, my score of happiness is 9. I'm happier than you are. Well, that's not necessarily the case. It's too subjective. What the Greeks would say when it came to subjective standards, they might say something like, good compares to great in the way that 1 compares to 10. What they will not say is that good is 1 and great is 10, because that creates a logical error. You see, the numbers are just an analogy. It's like me saying, well, happiness is like eating a piece of cake. That's an analogy. Now, if we're going to go around the world and assuming that happiness is eating a piece of cake, we're starting to eat the menu. We're starting to eat the analogy. And analogies are only there to help understanding, not to create it. If you're interested in more on this idea of how argument by analogy is actually logically not possible, go to the Hypnotic Frames Masterclass, where we really spend a lot of time looking at this analogy and how analogies can be abused. You can use an abusive analogy where you start comparing things that really can't compare, or you take the analogy way out of proportion so that it starts breaking down, but you're still using it at the breakdown point to prove a point that you really can't prove. And this is the problem with numbers. Numbers is fine if you're playing with 1 to 10 scales as a simple comparison. You know, I feel good, therefore it's a 1. I feel great, therefore it's a 10. So good to great, 1 to 10. We've got a kind of rough scale to measure it with. And this is, by the way, something that therapists love to use. It's a great scale to use when you're dealing with hypnosis in terms of fears and phobias and anxieties. You're on a scale of 1 to 10, where's your fear? But we're not confusing that scale by saying, well, one client had a 10, the other client had a 10, all fish phobias are a number 10. And all bird phobias are number 8. So fish phobias are worse than bird phobias. We can't make that mistake. The problem comes, and this is where the analogy becomes abusive, is if you begin to believe that good is 1 and that 10 is great, then you can start multiplying greatness. 10 times 10 is 100. So therefore 100 must be a special category of greatness. So if I feel great when I eat cake and I feel good when I eat, you know, leaves, and I feel pretty decent, you know, somewhere between the two, when I'm eating hamburgers, well, then when I'm eating hamburgers and cake, I must be, you know, 50% happier than when I'm just eating cake. Well, that's not necessarily true. I may be just as happy. In fact, eating cake might be like the sum total of my happiness that I'm capable of. But did I assume that just by adding another 5 points from eating the actual hamburger? Again, that's where the analogy breaks down. Now, I'm making a very, very crude example here. And the reason for that is because when it comes to the psychometric testing, in other words, psychological variants, people have tried to come up with more sophisticated solutions to exactly this problem. In fact, this has been a hot topic in psychology for many, many years. Back in 1946, a man called Stanley Stephen Smith decided to solve this whole problem by basically saying there's going to be different types of measurements, different levels of measurements that are more reliable or less reliable. And basically, all you have to do, you don't have to concern yourself with what numbers mean. In other words, 1 is good, 10 is great. All you have to care about is, can you assign numbers according to a rule? In other words, if people say they feel good, they will always get a 1. If people say they feel great, they will always get a 10. Now, if you do this, according to Stephen Smith, or Stanley Stephen Smith, if you do this, then you can actually start comparing things. Because, you know, 100 people say they feel great, you've got lots of scores of 10, now you can start doing some interesting mathematics with it, and it'll be valuable, it'll be useful, and there'll be some truth in it, just because you have a quote-unquote standard measure. But there are all kinds of problems with this. For example, you might think good is not as good as great, or vice versa. You might think good is better than great. So if you give me an answer of good and Fred gives me an answer of great, you might mean the same thing. But because you're using a certain word, well, now we've got a number value to it. So you're starting to compare apples and oranges, bananas and pears. And that's before we've even designed any experiments, before we even decided what can we actually measure. Another possibility is to use something called the rush model, where people tend to actually decide ahead of time, here are the criteria for measuring something, and then spend a lot of time afterwards deciding whether or not the things that they've measured match up to the measurement criteria they set up in the first place. It's a much more difficult task to do, and again, it's subject to all kinds of problems, although it tends to be a slightly more, shall we say, acceptable way of measuring things. The problem with most psychometrics is that the bulk of them are stuck in the Stanley Stevens Smith model, which is basically to assume that if you say it's so, you can put a number of values onto it, and that starts being valuable data. Now, I wouldn't go anywhere near as far as suggesting that all psychometrics are so flawed that the information is fundamentally useless. What I would say, however, is that as rough rules of thumb, as rough guides, you can get a lot of information out of these, which are very useful. However, to try and pretend there's any kind of level of precision in these things, well, at these points, I start having real doubts, and it starts getting into territory of people having turf wars and really starting to protect their own ideas for all kinds of reasons. So our very first problem is, we don't know what to measure and what those measurements, how to use those measurements in the first place. Now, even if we assume we can get past that, which we haven't yet, remember, what we're talking about in the first few sessions, sessions 1 and 2 of this masterclass, is really to develop rough guides, character sketches, which you begin to fill out with more and more and more experience. As such, these are systems that grow, and they grow according to each individual. With the more exposure you have to one individual, the more accurate that model tends to become. That's very different to saying, well, I'm going to do one 15-minute test, at the end of which I'll know how you will be for the rest of your life. It's a very, very different thing to saying. I much more prefer the approach which says, well, we're going to make a hypothesis here, we're going to have a little character study here, and then we're going to refine it as time goes by. And the longer we have an interaction, the more refined my model will get. I think that's fundamentally a much more honest way of proceeding. But let's say that you could measure something, and if you can measure it and create that and get past that number problem, there's a second problem that starts arriving. And this is to do with the naming problem, the normalization. Names start to confuse the results because people start to believe the names given to these things, and that's basically just marketing. Even psychologists are prone to the whole marketing approach. Let me give an example of what I mean. We talked a moment ago about IQ tests, and again, the Stanford-Binet IQ test being the classic model for it. Now, people start talking about IQ tests, and then later on, of course, about intelligence. How intelligent are you? Well, my intelligent number is 127, yours is 100, his is 33, and so he's stupid, I'm clever, and you're okay. Now, there's some problems with this. Aside from the number values problems, well, what are they actually measuring? Just because it's called an intelligence test, actually it's called intelligence quotient, which is very different from actually measuring intelligence, doesn't actually make it so. The first problem you have is in definition. What do you actually mean by intelligence? Do you mean your ability to learn? Do you mean your ability to solve problems? If it's the former, how do you measure learning? In terms of volume, in terms of data? If it's the latter, how do you remember problems? How do you measure problem solving? Is it in terms of what kind of problems? If someone is great at climbing trees, but can't do maths to save his life, does that make him more stupid or more intelligent than someone who does the functions the opposite way around? Now, when it comes to intelligence, this has been a critique that's been going on for many years now, and people started talking about the idea of being intelligent in different ways. Logical intelligence, we've got creative intelligence, musical intelligence, or physical intelligence. I think that's a much more interesting way of classifying these things, but even then, there are some fundamental flaws which can create problems. But coming back to this idea of people eating the menu, naming things, making them so. The Stanford-Binet IQ test, what it basically measures is your ability to think abstractly and use your left brain thinking mechanism at the same time. So it's abstract left brain thinking. Basically, it measures how much of an air-type thinking pattern, how much of an air-type personality you are. If you're off the scale air, you'll have a great IQ, a really high IQ level, and you'll be able to join Mensa and all kinds of other smart people. If, on the other hand, you're one of the other types, for example, a fire type, which is very concrete and at the same time very right brain, you might have massive difficulties. You might end up being a dunce as far as the Stanford Binah IQ test is concerned. And yet, you would probably be way more successful in life than the person who can solve all these academic problems, but not necessarily the life problems. Incidentally, I'm not suggesting that AIR people can't solve life problems. I just want to make a dramatic comparison in order to prove a point, which is that these tests are very, very narrowly defined, and therefore, what the way they're used and what they mean can must be very narrowly confined. So just because someone calls a test a psychometric, a character profile, a character test, a temperament type, and so on, doesn't mean that you are that kind of person. It doesn't mean that test is correct. It can only tell you what it's measured. And even if the measurements have overcome the flaw problem, all it can do is tell you that the way that you answered it is this. Next, we have another problem, which is kind of related to the idea of naming, and it's the idea of interpreting the results. What does that result actually mean? This again, the Stanford Binah IQ test is a classic example of what I mean by this. People start assuming that a high IQ score means you're intelligent, that you're smart. Well, it's true in some respects, you're smart in a certain type of way. Sure, great. But it doesn't necessarily mean that you'll be a greater success in life, that you're a better person, that you'll be able to solve day-to-day problems in a better way. All it means is that for the class of problems that have been defined in that particular test, you will be able to solve them more quickly, more easily, and more accurately over the long run than someone else who's got a quote-unquote lower score than you. Now, this might seem self-evident, but consider the following problem. I've given this analogy in previous masterclasses, but it really shows a problem nicely. Let's assume that some research scientist, a social scientist, decides to go into schools and discover what is it that makes good children, good readers out of children. So he measures everything imaginable: hair size, shoe size, classroom size, everything that they can measure, they measure, put all the numbers into a great big table, then do some number crunching at the end of which they try and find out patterns. We know that these kids are great readers, these kids are decent readers, these kids are bad readers. Let's see how else they compare to each other. Now, as he does these numbers, this research scientist suddenly discovers an amazing fact, and this fact is absolutely true, that the children which wear the largest shoes tend to be better readers. So, if you're going to go into a school and you look for kids that wear large shoes, chances are that kid is going to be able to be a pretty damn good reader. Now, what does it mean? Well, at this point, the research scientist gets very excited and goes, "Great, I know how to deal with this now. What we're going to do is we're going to tell parents to buy bigger shoes, and so their kids will be better readers." This is a classic example of a logical fallacy, someone coming to the wrong conclusion based on data that says very little but seems to say a lot. In reality, we of course know what's going on there. Kids with bigger shoes are older, they've been in school longer, they've practiced more. So the shoe size is just an indirect indicator of how much practice they've put in, and that amount of practice is going to be a pretty good indicator of how well they can read. It's ridiculous to tell children to wear bigger shoes because bigger shoes isn't going to give them more practice time. And yet, we have fallen foul of this kind of logical fallacy over and over and over again. And the real trouble is that people start paying attention to the interpreted results that social scientists, and I include in that psychologists, make, and don't actually question the very nature of the background that came before it because it's just too much effort. So what ends up happening is you start having strange circumstances like the following. For many years in France, it was impossible for anyone over 60 years of age to actually rent an apartment. How did this come to pass? Well, some well-meaning bureaucrat decided that it would be a terrible thing to have old people lying on the streets homeless. So he decided to pass a law in which basically forbade anyone that is renting out an apartment to someone over 60 years of age. It actually forbade them to throw them on the street for virtually any reason. Even if the person would stop paying their rent, you couldn't kick them out. Now think about this. Whilst there are some very decent people out there who'd carry on paying their rent regardless, if you think about it, there's going to be 1,000 people out there over 60 years of age. How many of those are going to bother paying rent if they know for a fact that they can stay there rent-free for the rest of their life and never get kicked out? No consequences. Whether they pay or they don't pay, they still get to have exactly the same lifestyle. Surely the temptation would be to start delaying your payments, and when there's no consequences, you delay them further until the delayment period is so long you may as well not be paying it at all. So what the consequence of this, of course, there were landlords out there who refused to rent out apartments to people of a certain age just because they knew they'd get stuck with it or that there was a risk of being stuck with it. That's just one example, one bureaucrat making a massive logical error. Surely social scientists are better than this. Well, it turns out that they're not. In the US, there was an interesting study, again by social scientists, that came to the following absolutely brilliant conclusion. They measured, or they went out there and started to investigate, you know, what makes the social fiber in a society be strong. So they decided to look for two big indicators. Number one, family stability. Number two, we're talking about wealth in terms of financial stability. If they were socially stable and they were financially stable, that was a pretty good indicator that that's the kind of the moral backbone of society, the kind of thing that makes a society great. Now, let's assume they were correct about that, even though there are questions that needed to be asked, if that's a good enough test, let's assume that he was correct about this. They went out and spent millions of dollars, or maybe just hundreds of thousands of dollars, questioning hundreds of thousands of people, and found, to their great amazement, that people who owned their own homes tended to be more socially and financially stable. Now, that's kind of like saying that kids with big shoes can read better. And in the same way that we made the ridiculous assumption that wearing bigger shoes will allow you to actually read better, this social scientist went around and said, hey, I just discovered some great social new amazing fact. If we help people to own their own homes, they'll be socially more stable and they'll be financially more stable. It's the same logical fallacy. Now, it might actually be true. It might actually be true that when you help someone buy their own home, so once they're actually the owner of a home, that psychological things get started, they'll become socially and financially more stable. However, that study did not prove it. And there's a bigger problem behind that, because a whole bunch of policy was made off the back of the conclusion, which is fundamentally flawed. As a result of which, the legislature allowed the whole process of something called subprime mortgages to be made, basically mortgages made to people who financially really are bad risks, on the hope that these people, once they own their own homes, will become more financially stable. If they're more financially stable, they should be able to pay off their mortgage payments, and hence everyone's happy. More homes get owned, more stability, more finances, etc., etc., etc. Of course, the big flaw in the whole mechanism, the fly in this whole ointment, is the fact that just owning your home doesn't help enough people become socially and financially stable, and the whole thing ended up collapsing on itself. And so I want to just impress upon you that it's actually a very difficult thing to first of all choose measurement and the correct yardstick, then actually apply that yardstick when it comes to subjective questions or subjective content. And once you apply that yardstick and you have it applied properly, that you can actually make an interpretation of what those results actually mean. There is a fourth problem, and this is called experiment bias. Basically, people will tend to prove the things that they want to prove. If you're looking for a certain result, you'll tend to find it. Now, this is something which is the psychometric and personality theory is particularly prone to. Someone comes up with a nice idea, it sounds great, then they go out there and go, let's see if it's true. But they're already tainted. By the fact that they are looking for certain types of people, they're going to find them. And I'm going to warn you right now, the system I've given you, the four types, the four elements, are a form of experimental bias. If you go out there and you look for these people, you will find them, and you'll be able to categorize people in these categories. And that's one of the big reasons I keep emphasizing to you. These are character sketches. These are rough guides. These are thumbnail guides. These are things that begin the process of investigation to ease you into the whole idea of making predictions and reading people, etc. And from time to time, you're going to get it wrong. You're going to say, oh, this person's very earthy. Then you're going to do something and go, oh my God, I would never expect an earth person to work that way. Now, instead of getting upset with them and say, hey, get back to being your earth type so that you're back in your little category, what you end up doing is you turn around and say, okay, what could have caused this difference? And you start bringing the other polar responses to figure out, okay, what quirks makes this person more than what I expected them to be? And so your model gets refined and you'll be able to read people better and better. Over time, my hope is that this becomes so intuitive that you can just read people through a few minutes of conversations without necessarily having put labels on why you're doing it. This is just training wheels. So the four types, the four elements, are just training wheels to get you to become sensitive to people and to read these other cues so that you start collecting information in a way that your mind can actually usefully apply. That's very different to saying these four people exist and that's it. These are the categories and you just have to do this little test here and that's how people are. It's a very, very big difference. One will lead to experimental bias, which means you'll find the things you want to find, whether they're true or not. In the other, you're just creating little models which keep getting refined as you gain more experience. Now, that's the background to what we've got to say. The four key problems are you don't know necessarily what you're measuring, so numbering things actually confuses the results when it comes to subjective content. Number two, you can confuse the results themselves just by naming things. By naming things one way or another, even if you yourself aren't confused, people around you will start misinterpreting what those things mean, adding more meaning than actually exists within it. And as a result, just like we have with IQ test, you have complexes being created, you have people being offered jobs or denied jobs as a result of something that actually doesn't really exist. Next, we have the problem of actually interpreting the results. Assuming you can actually find something worth measuring and you measure it properly and you even name it properly. It's assuming we can do all those things, what does it actually mean? What are the results? What do those large shoes mean to us? And is it something that's actually useful? That's something, again, which is very difficult to tell. Finally, we've got the whole idea of experimental bias. Now, I want to put all this into a certain context, which is that in social sciences, we have a form of mathematics, statistical mathematics. They've developed all kinds of different statistical models to try and prove this, that, and the other, and tease different types of information out. As far as I can tell, most of those statistics are just about as useful as the emperor's new clothes. In other words, they're more useful to convince others that you're right, to bamboozle the general world and sometimes experiment themselves that he's right, than actual useful measures of actual characteristics and so on. In my mind, most of these statistical models are little more value than a shaman shaking his rattle. It becomes really impressive to the audience, and the shaman might even believe in it, but the thing that actually is working behind the scenes isn't the actual rattle. It's not necessarily the spirits coming through and doing their thing. There's something else going on. So just because someone is trying to dazzle you with science, don't necessarily get carried away by it. Everything still comes down to the basic principles of logic. If you can work it out logically, if you can see the correlation, then chances are there is that correlation. If you can't, you want to be starting at a skeptical point. And first of all, my starting point would be to assume that there's some flaw in their method and then work backwards from that. Now, I might be wrong. Great. But more often, I think, I'll probably be right. And it's kind of an example of the bigger shoes making better readers sort of dynamic. Why do I emphasize all this? Well, I think it's part of the ethics of applying what I'm about to show you, because we're about to actually create our own psychometric test, something that's going to stand the test of time, stand right up there with the big boys and girls, things that there are entire corporations out there, multi-million dollar corporation, and all that they do is administer a variation of one simple test, which is basically somewhere between 60 and 500 questions, so depending on how anal or precise the experiment wants to be. And they're making claims about these tests, which I don't think they can actually back up when you would look at them from the beginning onwards. In other words, if you measure every point along the way, if you check the logic of everything they've done along the way, there are too many flaws for these things to be anything other than what we've talked about, which is, again, right back to the general prime or the general idea. It's a rule of thumb. It's a character sketch and nothing more at this point. So with that idea, I'd like you to run you through some of what these big boys are. A lot of these are actually copyrighted, trademarked, and in order to actually take the test, you'd normally have to pay anywhere between a couple of dollars and a couple of $100 to be allowed to be using this test on one individual. Now, once we've gone through some of these different tests, just so you see how similar they really all are, then you'll actually have the keys to actually create your own test. And if you wanted to go off and trademark it, call it some strange sort of intelligence, emotional type indicator, hey, off you go. You've got a great career selling things to people that are actually very simple, but look really sophisticated. My personal preference, of course, is just to use the four types, the four elements, as rough character guides to aid me in understanding people around me better and predicting how they'll behave, and also helping me to shape my suggestions so that I can influence them better. That's my interest. If you want to go down the other route, then here's how you do it. Let's start off with, what are you measuring? The simple answer to this is, you're going to measure polarities. That's basically what 99% of psychometrics and personality and IQ and other tests out there tend to measure is a polarity. It's, are you this or that? Now, you've come across dozens of polarities. We covered them all in sessions 1 and 2. So let's look at some of the classics in the field. The first one's called PAPI, or Personality and Preference Inventory. This was invented in the 1960s by Dr. Kostick. And basically, they look at what he calls 10 needs and 10 roles. Now, the 10 needs are basically 5 sets of polarities. So the 10 needs are essentially controlling others or needing for rules or supervision, which is basically wanting to be controlled yourself. The next thing is the need for change versus the need to finish a task. Again, that's the idea of certainty versus options. Then we have the next two needs being the need to be noticed versus the need to be part of a group. So basically, they're looking at a particular aspect of extroversion and introversion at this point, to be noticed, to stand out, to be blended into the group, stand back and be more kind of quiet and less noticed. The need to relate closely to people versus the need to be forceful and strong. Just the idea of dominance here. You've got the need to achieve a task, and then they have the need to support a task. Now, these sound like they're 10 different needs, but they're actually just 5 polar opposite. The need to achieve a task versus the need to support someone. That's basically task versus people orientation. Again, one of the poles that we talked about in the previous session. So these 5, or should I say, these 10 needs, which has been built up in this personality and preference inventory, are basically just 5 poles, and you ask a bunch of questions about each of the poles to give a quote-unquote score, and then the biggest score, no matter how complicated you want to make your calculations, ultimately what it comes down to is, the biggest score wins. And then you can turn around and say, okay, you've got a high need to control others, and you've got a low need to be controlled by others. Great, well done. The second function of the PAPI scale is basically the idea of roles. Again, they've pulled out 10 roles, and roles basically means types. You've already come across 4 basic roles: earth, air, fire, and water. They take the same basic ideas, the same basic roles, and they just pull out nuances and look for different things in those roles. So they talk about the leader, the organizer type, the person who's interested in details, the conceptual thinker, the social harmonizer, the person that makes easy decisions, the person who works at a steady pace, the person who shows emotional restraint, the hard worker, and the integrative planner. Now, just by those labels alone, you should have a pretty good idea that we're just talking about different aspects of the earth, fire, air, and water types. And all you need to do now is focus on a different kind of polarity. And you'll go, okay, this person's more leader, this person's more organizer, this person's more of a conceptual thinker, this person's more of a details thinker. Think about what we're talking about here. We're talking about abstract versus concrete. We're talking about exactly the same things that we've been talking about in the last 2 sessions. We're just making a finer distinction. We're splitting more hairs to make it seem more sophisticated, more complex. We're adding interesting words in order to make it seem more, shall we say, scientific. But that's just using the number problem and the naming problem as a way of disguising the fact that we're talking about exactly the same thing, really. And personally, I'd rather keep it simple and make the elegance come out in how many layers of simplicity you can add together to create something sophisticated, rather than trying to bamboozle people with mathematics and scare them into believing what you're saying because they feel too inferior to actually try and question this quote-unquote science behind it all. Let's look at another test. Here's the one called Myers-Briggs. This is one of the classic. This is something which is huge, and hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people have taken this. They've made a huge amount of money just administering this in organizations and so on. And again, it has some value. It has some very interesting value. But the interesting thing about Myers-Briggs, it brings essentially out 16 character types out. These 16 types basically fall into four categories, and guess what? They conform to exactly the same four categories we've talked about: earth, fire, air, and water. So how do they construct their personality thing? Do they have some crazy, amazing insight? Do they have some amazing mathematical tool or model to discover what personality type you are and what that means about you? No. They have four poles. Each of those four poles you've already dealt with or met in one form or another. The first pole they look for is extroversion versus introversion. So they'll use a little E or a little I in order to make it look a little bit more scientific and kind of create an equation. Extroversion and introversion, you know about. How outgoing are you? How shy are you? How retiring are you? Sensing versus intuition is the next pole. By sensing, they basically mean, do you use your five senses? Are you in the world? Do you look for information with your five senses? Or intuition is not necessarily intuition in terms of intuit something. That's something, funny enough, they call intuition feelings. In their system, intuition basically means, do you think more? Are you more in your thoughts? Are you more in the internal world of ideas versus in the external world of the senses? And hence, we've got basically concrete versus abstract thinkers. The concrete thinkers are using the senses, they're in the world. Abstract thinkers are inside their minds using concepts, sensing intuition. So that's a pole you're already familiar with. Then they have the next pole, which is thinking versus feeling. Here we're basically talking about left brain versus right brain functions. We're talking about thinkers who are logical, rational, and so on, versus feelers who are intuitive, use emotions, jump to conclusions in terms of making intuitive leaps and that kind of thing. We're basically talking about right brain versus left brain thinking and things that come from it. Right brain thinkers are more about connection and harmonizing. Left brain thinkers more about creating distinctions and can therefore be perceived as being more hard-nosed or unapproachable. Finally, we have the judging and perceiving functions. Those are essentially the same things as options versus certainty. Again, these are, shall we say, tangentially related to right brain versus left brain thinking. They're not as direct as, say, sensing and intuition, but there's a strong correlation between people who are right brain thinkers and people who are feelers and people who are perceivers and vice versa with thinkers who are rational, who are left brain thinkers and who like to judge things, who are certainty oriented. Again, this is nothing new to us. This is something we covered in the previous sessions as well as the first session.